Good morning, everyone. I would like to call to order the House Transportation Committee on Transportation Policy this fine morning of February 1st, 2017. And note that this is my husband's birthday. Happy birthday, Jeff, if you're watching. I won't be seeing him till Friday, so he's on his own for this birthday. Welcome to our committee. As the first opening committee of the session, I'm delighted to have a full complement of new members to join us on the Transportation Committee this morning. I believe Representative McLean and I are the only returning members. And what I'd like to do to tee us up is give you an opportunity to learn a little bit about who we are. So I'm going to give each of our members just a moment to introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about why transportation is the center of their universe. And I'll begin over here with Representative Evans. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Chair. I represent House District 20, which truly the river runs through it. That's why transportation matters so much to us. Polk County and Marion County are in the district that I represent, Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, and then parts of South Salem. The two bridges that span the Willamette are of critical concern, as well as the nodes of trying to get goods from farms throughout the area to market. So transportation is at the heart of really why the reason I'm serving, and I'm grateful to be a part of the committee.
Right. Thank you.
Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Greg Barreto, House District 58, Wallowa County, Union County, and part of Umatilla County, and it is a long ways from there to here. And we did get in this committee in 2015, one of my first bills was a increase in the speed limit, and we did get that. And But it looked like this was a fun committee when I testified in front of the committee. Representative McEwen was the chair then, and it looked like a great committee to be on. And I didn't ask for it, but I'm certainly glad to be here. I'm a small businessman. This is my second term, and we're glad to be here. So
thank you, Representative McLean.
Thank you. I'm Representative McLean, and I'm from West Washington County. Forest Grove, Cornelius, and West Hillsboro is my District 29. And I've always been interested in transportation, and I actually used to read about how they started with wagons in England to actually get manufacturing going and how they delivered their products all the way back. That was something of interest to me when we were reading about manufacturing and history when I was in college. And it's a situation where I live in a very vital part of the state of Oregon, where we have a lot of business, economics, and transportation connect business, recreation, and families being able to get from home to school to work is very, very important. And Paul already indicated, you know, we're talking about bridges, we're talking about ports, we're talking about roads, and it's a complete multimodal type of system that's going to be balanced. And I'm also lucky enough to sit on the Joint Transportation Committee, and so I expect transportation to be at least in my number one and two for the whole session. So really enjoying having new members and look forward to getting to know you.
Vice Chair Vile.
Rich Vile from Shoals, representing House District 26, which is the Wilsonville all the way to South Hillsboro stretch, the economic epicenter of Oregon at this point, and frankly, the fastest growing residential portion of Oregon by a long shot, with South Hillsboro, Sherwood, Wilsonville all having significant expansions of the UGB having occurred. We're expecting tens of thousands of homes a year over the next foreseeable future. Just as a fun fact, Representative McLean and I have known each other for about 25 to 30 years. We had our kids in 4-H together up in Hillsboro at the Washington County Fair, and it's really a pleasure to work with her. I've been the chair of the Washington County Planning Commission for the last 4 years and been on the Planning Commission for about 10 years. Have been working around the Washington County transportation issues, the West Side Bypass, which has been a here and gone many times, and many other Washington County transportation issues for a long time. And I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to work on this committee this session.
Great. And we also are pleased to have a new admin staff representing us and working with us this session, and I'd like to have Mr. Walker take an opportunity to introduce himself as well. He's new to the policy side of working this building.
Yeah. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Walker with the Policy and Research Office. I'll be the committee analyst, or tour guide, as I like to say. And this is my first session with the Policy and Research Office, but for the last 11 years, I've worked for the Legislative Fiscal Office, so I do have some experience in the building.
Thank you. So committee members, if you have questions on bills, if you need information, Tim is at your service to staff this committee, and we have a lot of new going on, so please take advantage of this office and ping Tim if you need things. I'm Katty McEwen. I represent House District 9, which runs from the southern edge of Coos Bay to the northern edge of Yahats and in almost to Elmira. So I cover a fairly large geographic area. And as Representative Barreto noted, there are those of us who travel long distances to get here. We are part of the few, I think. but it's an honor to chair this committee again. This will be my third term on the committee, my second term chairing, and I'm delighted to be here. Vice Chair Meek.
Good morning. Mark Meek from House District 40, which is Oregon City, Gladstone. And I'm kind of in the middle of Clackamas County there. And I've served on the Clackamas County Planning Commission. I was the chair for the last 2 years, but I did resign for this position, so I'm not as dedicated as Representative Vile, but I am dedicated. But transportation, as you know, the federal government has targeted the Abernathy Bridge in the Stafford area, part of 205, as a major bottleneck and kind of a issue for transportation and economic, health. So that's very important to me, and part of my work on the Planning Commission related to the transportation system plan, including active transportation. So I'm very excited to work on the committee this year and look forward to doing some good work for Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Hey, good morning. Carl Wilson, House District 3. That is entirely contained down in Josephine County. A lifetime resident of the county. I did three terms back in the 90s and early 2000s, so I know a number of you. Radio is what I do. Have a couple of radio stations in Grants Pass, and they've been in the family for 60 years this year. I asked to be on this committee. I like to travel. I have done, I would say, 500,000 miles by motorcycle since the day I got my driver's license at age 16. And I have spent most of the last 14 years traveling from west coast to east and back numerous times, enjoying just about every state in the union. Like I say, I do love to travel, and only by motorcycle, and that gives me an opportunity to take a look at a whole lot of pavement in a lot of states. So I have an opportunity to compare Oregon to quite a number of states, and I definitely have my opinions about that. So looking forward to the committee, like I say, I asked to be here because this subject has always interested me. I was on the Transportation Committee briefly in 1998 when I came in by appointment. So glad to be here and looking forward to all the subjects that we're going to be undertaking. Thank you.
Representative Witt, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I am the representative from House District 31, which if you visualize the map of Oregon, the upper left-hand corner, there's a big hump.
The nub.
That hump is fairly much mine. It is Columbia County, the northern portion of Washington County, and that sliver of Multnomah that runs between the two of them. I've always been struck by the fact that our state's economy is linked at the hip with international trade and commerce that goes in and out of our state's ports. But if we were to try and access any one of those ports from virtually anywhere in our state, we'd embark on a third world journey. And I think that is suggestive of a lot of our state's transportation network that is thoroughly inadequate to meet the needs of our citizens in the year 2017. Madam Chair, while I am not so naive as to ever believe that we will get an interstate highway to any one of our ports, I do believe that there are very significant improvements that need and must be made to our state's transportation network, and I look forward to working with you and the other very, very fine members of this committee.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Representative Noble, welcome.
Thank you. I'm Ron Noble from District 24, which is North Yamhill County and South Washington County. And transportation is one of those committees that I actually asked to be on. And part of that is because of this wonderful 99 corridor from the top of Rex Hill down through the bottom of, or south end of McMinnville. And my history, I actually spent in between, well, summers while I was in college as an engineering tech back when we used plumb bobs and chains worked on a few projects in the valley here. That combined with my career in law enforcement, I'm very interested in traffic safety and in developing highways. I've been across the United States. I don't think I've put a 500,000 miles on my motorcycle, but I probably have a few years to go still. So both on four wheels and two wheels. So I'm glad to be here, and thank you.
Well, I got stopped by the cops.
Thank you. Well, Representative, you tapped into a memory for me. My father ran an office supply business, but in the course of that, he also sold technical equipment, and part of it was survey equipment. Mm-hmm. And I recall those days when they were my father was selling that equipment to all the surveyors around town. So we are of a similar vintage, I think. I still have my first slide rule, so that's something. Anyway, thank you for your introductions, and to the transportation community out there, we have a very capable committee here, and we're very excited about getting to work and seeing what we can do to make the improvements that people are going to ask for with the bills that they bring to us. What I'd like to do now is turn to Vice Chair Vile. The adoption of the committee rules is the next thing on our agenda this morning.
And for the benefit of the new members of the House, I had to ask this question, and I thought I'd just mention to you that the rules that we're about to adopt are the same rules that all committees adopt, and they're the model rules. With that, Madam Chair, I move the committee adopt the committee rules as provided.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vile. Vice Chair Vile moves the committee adopt the committee rules. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please. And by the way, it is my habit as chair. Some chairs do not do this, but I feel it's important that when we take a vote that your voices are heard. So in this committee, we will always have the clerk call the roll when we're taking a vote. So please call the roll.
Representative Loretto.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Vile.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion passes and the committee rules are adopted. And next on our agenda, since we have so many new members, I thought it might be worthwhile to have Mr. Mather, Ms. Bohard, and Mr. Costales come in and do a little, I'll call it transportation 101 for all of us as we begin to work on issues that can be very specific to information that they're going to provide us today. And then we will hear from Mitch Zwecker from the Department of Aviation, and then we'll go into our public hearing on a couple of bills. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our committee. I know you've done this before, and I appreciate you coming to help enlighten us and get us geared up for the session. So please, in any order you prefer. There you go. And just for you all who would prefer to look at something on a screen close, your meeting materials are in the agenda for today. You can go in and look at them if you prefer, or you can look at on the screen, whichever works best for you as committee members. Mr. Mather.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Mather. I'm the Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm going to kick off a series of short briefings from our different divisions at ODOT and just what we do. We're going to give you a real high-level overview of just what we do. There's a lot of nuance and a lot of other work that we'll cover, I'm sure, in other briefings or other topics as they come before you. So starting with the Highway Division, as I think a lot of you noted in introductions, that the highway system is the backbone of our transportation system in Oregon. The state highway system makes up about 8,000 state highway miles, including the interstate, federally designated routes, Oregon routes, and other roads. It carries, trucks carry about 70% of the freight in this state. It is vital to the economy of the state. And one of the pieces that I'd always remember is of those pieces of truck traffic, the heaviest trucks, the truck and trailer combinations that are 105,000 pounds, are really what makes Oregon businesses competitive in Oregon. There's two things in the Highway Division, two major areas that we have. The first is our maintenance area. Our maintenance crews have been very busy this winter in the winter operations that they do. Snow plowing, floods, rock slides, those type of emergency pieces of operation that they do. They also are responsible for incident response, whether it's a crash, whether it's a rock fall, whether it's a piece of debris in the roadway. They're responsible to respond to those, keep our highways open and safe. They also do the preventative maintenance of the highway, whether it's cleaning ditches, filling potholes, restriping roads, replacing signs. They are the crews that do that. Our crews are scattered throughout the state. We have 14 different districts, and each district has four or five different maintenance stations. So we have maintenance stations in virtually every corner of this state. From a staffing standpoint, they represent about half of the Highway Division. The Highway Division represents about half of ODOT, so they are about a quarter of what, from a manpower standpoint, of what you're going to see in ODOT is focused on just keeping our roads open, safe, and well-maintained. The second area within the Highway Division that we do, a major area, is our project delivery. I'll start with just how we select projects. Several of you are on planning commissions and work with planning commissions. Know that local plans, local comp plans, the transportation element of those comp plans are really the birthplace for a lot of our projects. That information, that data, working with local government, that partnership of land use and transportation comes together. We work with our area commissions on transportation, and the map here shows our various area commissions that we have around the state. These are advisory committees set up by the Oregon Transportation Commission. They have charters that are renewed every 2 years with our Transportation Commission. They are populated by city and county representatives, as well as business, transit, tribal, quite a broad variety. And they're very useful to us from advising us not only on project selection but on policies, and really for our local staff and our local managers to be engaged with community needs to ensure that our work is working with the community and fulfilling their needs. The other major area where we get our projects from, especially our bridge and our pavements, come from our various management systems. We have pretty sophisticated management systems that help us know what's the right investment on pavements or bridges or culverts at the right time, whether that might be a chip seal, might be a complete overlay. When is the right time with the funds that we have available to make those right investments to preserve our system and prolong its life? From there, we turn into design. During the design phase, we have extensive public involvement on projects. Many of you probably have been exposed to some of our public meetings that we have on various projects as we move through the design stage. About half of our work in the design stage is done by consultants. The other half is done by ODOT staff. I heard many of you noting in your introductions about plumb blobs and other kind of antiquated survey equipment that we have. That is really becoming, surveying in and of itself is becoming, it's becoming very different on our projects we have today. A lot of our work is transitioning out of doing that field work and surveying and moving to using GPS or LIDAR type data that is gathered without the traditional surveying methods. That data is then put into our computers for our designers to create a design file. That design file then is handed off to the contractor, who loads that data into their machinery, and that operator of that machine with the screen in front of them builds that road without ever having a stake on the ground for surveying. Has a great efficiencies, has great safety for workers and for traveling public, and is really revolutionizing our business. We're seeing projects done sometimes a year ahead of schedule, but typically 5, 10, 15% earlier, and we're seeing savings on projects that run 5 or 10% on project costs because of these innovations. We move into construction. It's a little hard to see there in the picture on the right, but the three excavators there on the right, you'll notice there's no stakes at all in that picture. Those operators are doing just as I described. They're taking that data and operating and building that roadway just based on the data that's loaded into those pieces of machinery. The two individuals on the left are our project inspectors, ensuring that we have a quality project. Again, traditionally, they've done work where they've filed their notes out in the field during the day on paper, come back in the office, load those into the computer or file those. We're moving to a paperless environment where they do on tablets, enter that once in the field, and it has a great efficiency for us there as well. They're also able to process things much faster. A change order typically would take up to a month to hand the paper off between the various places in ODOT to the Federal Highway Administration to get the various signatures before we could give the okay to contractors to move forward. This electronic, with electronic signatures, allows us to do that in about a day and keep the contractor moving. 100% of our work on the construction side is outsourced. So when you see contractors out there working, that's not ODOT staff. Those are the private contractors in Oregon. Just a little bit about the condition of our system and our various assets, and you'll hear a lot of this, I think, talked about during the session, especially in the Joint Committee. But we have a very aging system, a system that was built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, our bridges, pavements, and culverts. And the funding hasn't kept up with the aging of our system. It was largely designed with about a 50-year design life and was built about 50, 60 years ago. So our projections, as you can see in this graph for bridges, we're projecting that we're going to have bridge conditions gradually and then gradually decline over the next several decades. One of the other major issues that we're facing is the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and preparing our system for that. Again, most of our system was built before we even knew we had the vulnerability of a 9.0 earthquake. That was discovered in the late 80s, early 90s. Most of our system was built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So this is a graphic I have up here, just our plan of how we would approach, how we would prioritize different routes. But we have a whole study that we've done on the cost and the strategies and how we would approach this issue. Finally, I'll just end a little bit on funding. This is a graph that we have nicknamed the mountain chart, but it gives you kind of a snapshot of our overall funding picture over the last couple of decades. The blue base on the bottom are the federal funds that we receive through formula from the federal government. Those funds are largely used for our bridge, our pavement, our culvert projects to keep our system going. The projects in the various colors above are largely bonded programs that the legislature has passed. So going back to 2001 with the OTIA, or the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, the OTIA 1 and 2 was in 2001, and then OTIA 3 passed in 2003. Bonded programs, the OTIA 3 was largely bridge, where we bonded some existing bridge funds to address critical bridges on strategic routes. The Connect Oregon program you're going to hear about has been funded every session since 05, I believe, at some level through there. The ARRA are the federal stimulus dollars that came in 08 and 09, and then the Jobs and Transportation Act, which the legislature passed, again, a bonded program that was passed in 09. Many of those projects you probably have seen over the last several years around the state, whether it's the Woodburn Interchange, Sunrise Corridor, the Newburgh Project. Those are all major projects that were funded out of the Jobs and Transportation Act. We have let all those projects now are in construction and are wrapping up. Over the last 10 years, we've delivered 800 projects, $3.7 billion. When you add all those projects up, our successes, our failures in those, we are within 1% of our original authorization of those contracts.
Oh, committee, I think what we'll do is let the other two staff members do their presentations and hold questions. So if you have questions, jot them down, and then we'll have a discussion on all three of the presentations. Ms. Bohard, welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair McEwen, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohart. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator. And I think that you'll find that I have a very diverse portfolio. I do everything, or my staff, I should say, does everything from analytics to policy formulation to obligating funds for projects. And we work with all of the divisions within the agency. And we also have a number of partners that we work with, our cities, our counties, our universities, and stakeholder groups that run all the way to state police. We really are about, I think you'll see throughout this, really supporting a lot of the work that comes through the Highway Division. It's about supporting the identification of the right solutions and projects. I'll highlight this a little bit later, but so for instance, in our statewide plans, the Commission really used a great deal of that as they brought forward the investment strategy that set that long-term vision across all of Oregon. We collect and analyze data to understand the problems in our system and evaluate to find the best solution. So all the condition information, the graphs that Mr. Mather showed you really came from the data that we collect within our division. And we also manage the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, or the STIP, which I'm sure you all will hear a lot about. This is essentially our four-year capital program, which we update between 2 and 3 years, depending on the cycle. So some of that, I would say, are three key sort of areas of responsibility. And one of the things that I will note before I go into that is that essentially all of our work that's done within this division has been mandated either through federal or state requirements. So we do have a lot of federal requirements, and we have a great deal of that reporting responsibility within our division. We often talk about state's key performance measures, and we collect a lot of the data that's needed for those reporting requirements. But we have even more at the federal level, where they're looking at the condition of the system. We have to certify our mileage. We do a great deal of inventory of our system, and all of that data collection and reporting is done in our division. With regards to statewide planning implementation, a number of multimodal policy plans that really help to inform the decisions and to make investments. And I think what's really key about that is that we're bringing a diversity of users around with regards to building that vision and the goals that really guide not only the state, but what the community goals are as we move forward. And we couldn't do that without the cities and the county. So as we work on implementing these plans, we are working with them to take those policies and form them into action. One of the key things I think that we do within our division in a lot of ways is our fiscal responsibilities. Managing the STIP really leads that way for the construction of for construction projects to be delivered. We have to obligate all of the federal funding and the revenue forecasting so that we're able to really think about how we manage our cash flow. So I'm just going to highlight some of the specifics with regards to each of those. One of the key ones is our safety analysis and reporting. Unfortunately, we do have the responsibility of collecting all the reports on the fatalities that occur on our roadway system, and you're going to hear a little bit more from Troy Costales on that. But it is a requirement at the federal level that we provide that information. We're also responsible for collecting, analyzing, and reporting all of the traffic crashes that occur on our public roads. It's approximately about 56,000 a year. And we collect this data, again, these two gentlemen use it a great deal, but we also do it for our cities and our counties, our metropolitan planning organizations, who use it for engineering, education, enforcement. Obviously, we share that information with the state police as well. We also do the safety analysis for a motor carrier, and I think in a couple of days you're going to hear from the motor carrier division, so obviously the crash information, equally important to them. Talked a little bit already about the performance tracking, and then just a great deal of highway and intermodal data collection. We have what we call the Highway Performance Monitoring System, or HPMS. Again, congressional reports that we have to do, but we have about 2,700 sample sites throughout our state system where we're really analyzing the condition of the system and collecting, I think we have about 70 data points that we collect out of each of those systems. We also do the inventory across all of our assets and anything from traffic that crosses rail crossings. We maintain bicycle and pedestrian data. We maintain information around freight traffic counts. So a lot of data that's used by many. With regards to some of the safety, statewide planning work that we do, I think you all know, I've heard a number of you are members of planning commissions, so thank you, how important transportation planning is about really bringing the diversity of users together to establish that vision. The Oregon Transportation Plan is that umbrella document that we use for the vision of the transportation system. It was adopted by the commission in 2006. It's actually a requirement both at the federal level, the state level, and then our commission is also required to have a long-range plan. So we take that plan and use it in three ways. It's important to note that sets the vision for the state, not just for the agency. We have a number of modal plans that really are part of that overall document, everything from freight to bicycle and pedestrian, which is our most recent update. We're working on updating the public transportation plan, and even the aviation plan. I see that Director Schwecker is here. So the aviation plan, although done by another agency, comes within the umbrella of the Oregon Transportation Plan. I will say that our plans, though, are policy documents. So they don't have projects in them. It's when we work at the local level that we include projects. Really key to linking between the planning work that we do is some of the modeling and analysis. So we have nationally recognized transportation models. You heard Paul talk a little bit about the seismic plan. That was really data and information that came from our planning analysis. I think that Travis Brower is in the room next door talking about what we call rough roads. So it's really which was another look at what is the impact to our economy when we look at transportation. So we have a model that really integrates land use, transportation, and the economy, and it gets used throughout the agency. And finally, local government planning assistance. We have a transportation growth management program, which is a competitive grant program, but we really work with our local governments as they do their transportation system plans, and this is where our projects come from. So we're really integrating the needs, local land use needs as well as our transportation needs into one. As I mentioned, we have a number of fiscal responsibilities. So the STIP is close to $1.6 billion over 3 years. So we really have all the management responsibilities for that. So really supporting all of the setup and the accounting for each of the projects and all of the other reporting requirements that we have from Federal Highways. We also do it not just for our projects, but for city and county projects that are using federal funds. So we have that management oversight responsibility as well. And I think you heard Paul mention Connect Oregon. So I guess first I would have to say thank you. We've been very successful with six programs we've allocated, or the legislature has allocated $427 million. It's leveraged over $600 million. And we've in the process, we have 227 projects that came out of that. About 60 of them are left to be completed. And for those of you who don't know, Connect Oregon is for those non-highway modes. So bicycle and pedestrian, rail, marine, transit, and aviation. So a very important program. Our division has a responsibility for the project selection process and in really ensuring the accountability for all of the funding of that. So last but not least is our research program. This is primarily a federally funded program where we really are trying to test those problems, research those problems that have direct application to the field. So we research everything from structures to maintenance to active transportation to safety to environmental, you name it. We've done all sorts of projects. I think what's really key about that is another one of our partnerships is with our state universities. So most of the research is done in concert with and using the abilities of our state universities. Again, sort of that local government connection that we have what we call the T2 Training Center, Technology Transfer. So this is where we provide technical assistance, instructional materials, whatever to help our local transportation agencies. We do training around safety, work zones, those types of things. So it's something that we do throughout the state. So I guess I'll close by saying I think you can see that for the Transportation Development Division, we're about making sure the agency is meeting our federal reporting needs. And so that ensures that we get federal funds keeping going. So that's a key one. And I think as you think about the work that Highway Division does and Paul's presentation, you can see that we at TDD, we really essentially sort of buffer both sides of his portfolio. We provide the data, the planning, and the project selection work that helps to frame the project development and construction. And then on an ongoing basis, we're collecting the condition of the system, the traffic counts, the forecasting of our revenues, all which set the stage for the next round of planning and project selection. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So this might be a trick to see if that'll reach this far or not.
I'm going to reach across.
Yeah. So.
Good
morning.
Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And thank you for the invitation to be with you on the opening meeting of your committee
for
this
landmark day.
This session. Yes. So, for the Safety Division, really, there's just one focus, and that's a vision of zero. Whether that's from the employee safety responsibility that the division holds for all of the men and women that work for the agency, that's an internal view, or the external view across all roads and streets and highways within the state. Our job is to look at how do we achieve zero loss of life, zero injuries, zero incidents. There is no other acceptable number when it comes to human life. Our focus is statewide with customers and guests and travelers from point to point all across the state. We have a responsibility to deliver programs by our own hands, but also through others. Within the division, we have over 500 projects that are going at any one point in time. And we have a very high level of citizen involvement through the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, which is a statutory body, two executive order committees, the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety, and then lots of program advisory committees or task forces that we brought together just like recently, a distracted driving task force that worked the past few months prior to session to look at the growing epidemic related to distraction on roads and streets within Oregon. So part of context, the graph that's in front of you represents the last 20 years in the state of Oregon. There were over 8,000 people that have perished on Oregon's roads and streets in those last 20 years. As you look towards the right-hand side of that graph, you'll see that in the last 2 years there's been a dramatic uptick in the number of fatalities within Oregon, and it's not just unique to us. This is something occurring across the country and, in fact, across the entire globe. But that last 2 years, we've erased a decade of pretty dramatic improvement. And you see the prior years where the decline to where in 2013 as one of our most lowest years in quite a few decades within the state of Oregon. Later, I'll share a little bit of some of the causation factors that we could draw from some of this information to share with you and what that may mean for some potential policy conversations within your purview. For over 50 years, Oregon was at or above the national average fatalities based on the vehicle miles traveled within our state. But starting in 1999, all the way until 2014, we were below. We were better than the rest of the country. The last 2 years, for the first time in 20 years, that we are trending the other way. Within the safety division, and as Ms. Bohard mentioned, with performance measures, we have over 50 performance measures. Many of those are federally mandated, but through our advisory committees, we also have additional topical performance measures that we track to see how we're doing in different areas of highway safety. Our functions within the division could be split up into three different areas that of roles that we are assigned, whether that's from federal law, federal rule, state law, state rule, or from court case law, where we are responding to those directives. From the administration point of view, within the organization, focused inwardly, we have programs dealing with bloodborne pathogen, hearing conservation for our employees. As Mr. Mather pointed out, we've got folks that are exposed to heavy machinery in different areas. From the highway safety point of view, we are responsible statutorily for the teen driver education program, also for the motorcycle safety education program that new riders take before getting their endorsement on their driver license. And we have 18 different unique fund sources that come through the division, each with their own rules and regulations, timing, the use, the regulations on the use, what we can use those monies for, what is required from a match, and what is required from a reporting point of view. And we manage all of these and take the responsibility for running these programs from the administrative point of view. From the ambassador point of view, we help with the translation between the rules and the regulations, those that you and your predecessors have passed, into real-world application through training sessions and grants throughout the entire state, where we're dealing with employees, contractors, law enforcement, the judiciary, prosecutors, civil engineers, treatment providers, community advocates, the car seat technicians, nurses, EMS, and also the local fire providers around the state. At times, that approach that we take is multidisciplinary, where we bring a team together, and I'll share with you in a minute a little more detail on that particular piece. And our job is to be the supporter of the specific activities, including letting people know when there have been law changes to those professionals, as well as then to the broader general public. And that's where we come in from the advocation point of view. We promote best practices, and we help to raise the level of safety in personal and professional conversations, and our job is to be the professional champion within highway safety. In the world of employee safety, looking inward to our organization, as a large public agency with employees from corner to corner and working in all kinds of environments, we need to provide for a safe and healthy workplace. This includes the safety and security of our employees, our partners, our customers, and our guests. We have static work sites like large buildings to small sheds to mobile work sites that are on or around the transportation infrastructure. Our employees face and interact with the general public every day. There are times when that interaction presents risk and members of the public have harmful intentions. We need to prepare our staff for that ever-changing work environment around them. Our employees do a tremendous job at all hours, every day, throughout the entire year. A few of us are graying or maybe even losing a hair or two. ODOT has one of the longest serving team of employees and one that is also aging. As new employees come on board, our job is to help them gain the knowledge and skills to be safe and successful. The transfer of knowledge from one employee to the next is not just faced internal to the organization, but within highway safety, we face that externally too with our partners, where there are changes amongst the public safety agencies around the state that we work with. Most recently, we brought together a team with the Associate General Contractors, the Oregon Trucking Association, Oregon State Police, Oregon State University, to focus on the areas of work zone safety that Mr. Mather presented to you, about how do we have that technology transfer with those new tools, that new equipment, and with our public safety partners of what makes the most sense for the safety for those men and women on the ground in the area, as well as those that are moving through that work zone. That means we have the need to set aside some quality time for training. There's new equipment, there's new automation, new partners, ways to get things done differently. And we stand side by side with our public safety agency partners. But this must be practiced. The event on the slide banner that you see here has ODOT, the Oregon State Police, Fire, Emergency Medical Services, Rail, and Motor Carrier interests in this picture for this incident management. We can't afford to be stumbling over each other when an emergency is staring us in the face. So we need to take the time to practice what it is that we will deliver when an incident occurs. Then to the note I mentioned earlier about the last couple years with the increase in traffic fatalities in the state. The recent news the last couple years is not good. Traffic safety is the result of interaction between three factors: the vehicle, the driver, and the road environment. For example, a collision may include faulty brakes. That's attributed to the vehicle. Or it could be a situation where someone fails to observe a traffic signal, a human error. Or a road segment may have inadequate sight distance for the individual to see. That could be considered a road environment. Over 90% of the fatal crashes in the state of Oregon involve some form of human error. 90%. And this is some examples of what we've witnessed over the last 2+ years with an increased number of traffic fatalities. We've seen an increase in alcohol-related traffic fatalities over the last 24 months, 50% of an increase. We've seen an increase in lane departure, road departure crashes across the state, predominantly in rural settings, which many of you represent across the state. And we've seen a lack of seatbelt and car seat use. And that is on the uptick, about a 40% increase in the number of fatalities where someone was not buckled in, they or their children, within their vehicles. These errors are seemingly easy to fix. News reports have pushed this fatality increase in Oregon and nationally off to more miles being driven, more discretionary income, more drivers on the road. There is a relationship between all of those reasons, but first, we're after zero. We shouldn't be hiding behind some of these other numbers because, bottom line, someone has lost a life on the transportation network within our state. I don't want the next report to be someone from my family or from yours. Zero is that vision. Plus, the numbers don't line up. Oregon's experienced a 3-5% increase in travel. It does not equate to a 20% and 25% increase in the number of traffic fatalities that we've experienced. These three crashes on the screen for you come from Oregon State Police investigated crashes just within the last 2 months of 2016 as an example of what I'm talking about related to some of those errors. On the lower left, that pickup, this driver drifted off the shoulder, overcorrected, causing the vehicle to roll several times. Everybody in that pickup was ejected because nobody was wearing a belt. The driver was killed. The second passenger had life-threatening injuries, and a third was transported by Grand Ambulance. And the root cause to this is that the officer investigating believed that there was distracted driving behind the wheel when the incident occurred. On the upper right, this driver crossed the center line head-on into an oncoming vehicle. The two people in the oncoming vehicle were killed. The driver of the striking vehicle was charged with manslaughter, assault, reckless driving, and driving under the influence of intoxicants. Alcohol is believed to be the contributing factor behind the operator of that particular vehicle. On the lower right, the driver left the lane of travel, drifted off the roadway, and then rolled. The child passenger was ejected from the vehicle and pronounced deceased at the scene. The lack of seat belts is being considered one of the contributing factors to this crash and to that death. All of these crashes are tragedies. Every single one of them could have been prevented. Every single day in this state, millions of people travel in Oregon and reach their destination safe and sound. Our job collectively is to extend that same safe outcome to every single person, whether they're driving, riding, walking, scooting, skating, rolling. And we have achieved zero fatals on 100 different days last year. A few years ago, it was almost 200 days where we were fatality-free. Our job is to try and make that happen all year. We can't just look backwards. We need to look forwards as well. So what is it that, for me, keeps me up at night? And these are three very quick examples of what troubles me when looking forward. First is the invasive way distraction creeps into the workplace, and also while people are operating vehicles and walking around the transportation system. Our hope is with your leadership, we can create expectations of motor vehicle operators to put down the phone and concentrate on driving. That's your number one job as a driver. Focus on the driving task ahead of you. We convened a distracted driving task force alongside AAA and the Oregon State Police, and multiple disciplines were involved, including members of the Oregon Legislature, to help put in motion a full court press on what is fast becoming a highway safety epidemic from corner to corner of the state. Second is the growing use of impairing substances, legal and illegal, that lead to mistakes that are taking people's lives. Evidence of increased alcohol use, marijuana use, and homegrown concoctions behind the wheel make it to newspaper stories all too often. As a state, we're ill-equipped to enforce and test for impairment use by those that are operating on our transportation system. And lastly is the most vulnerable of all roadway users, and that is pedestrians. This is a problem troubling many states across the nation, and it's just not an urban issue. It's for all, no two incidents when a pedestrian is involved are alike. The errors and mistakes are owned by drivers and pedestrians alike. We're not going to get to zero if we pit people against each other. We need to provide the forum for unity. The traffic laws that you provide and that you approve are created to help people from being in the same place at the same time. If we follow those rules, we stand the best chance of avoiding harm or causing harm to others. In closing, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm proud to be part of the employee and highway safety community in Oregon. We have made significant progress, and we can make these numbers turn in the other directions. Others are counting on us, and we're counting on ourselves. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity for all of us to be present to you today and later this week on some of the elements of the divisions of the Department of Transportation.
Great. Thank you so much. What I'd like to do is just open this for questions, to have a conversation with this very very experienced staff that we have in front of us. Representative McLean?
Well, I'm going to start with safety because that's where we left off. But first of all, I've just gotten like two or three emails in the last couple of days, and it's been on safety and pedestrians. And one other issue that was mentioned that you didn't mention up there on the slide was new technology and including driverless cars. And I know that there's somewhere in ODOT a little committee, because I talked to Leah about it, that started to think about the predictions of what some of those issues might be. One example, I bought a new car recently, and the engine turns off every time you put your foot on the brake. So when you're at a stoplight, there's at least a 2 to 3 second, longer sort of lag, unless you get your foot really ready to get right onto the gas, and somebody right behind you almost plowed right into me, because as far as they're concerned, they were on their way. And so technology and how we work that into the slide, I think, is important. The pedestrian one was their issue. And I know you have a governor's safety committee and all of that, but I think it's important for us to kind of do an update on whatever your website on what's happening right now, because I'm going to be sending your PowerPoint, but I think it's important for us to keep updating the public on what we are trying to do, that we are not oblivious to the fact that there's more accidents and that pedestrians are almost getting hit. This one woman said she was within, seconds of being hit. And so it's important for us to keep them in the loop that we are concerned, interested, and supported. So I don't know if you have anything to say about tech.
Madam Chair and Representative McLean, autonomous vehicles and vehicles that talk to each other and talk to the roadway environment and vice versa are all part of what, from the strategy point of view for the agency, we are talking about that and what that means in different environments. And even with autonomous style vehicles coming, you still have all of us. Somebody is associated with that vehicle one way or another. And thinking about situations of how do they interact, what are the expectations, what are the rules of engagement that people need to understand, and that's part of what we hope you as a committee and as a body also look towards this session, is how do we set that framework forward so that everybody knows what their responsibility is and we don't end up creating unintended consequences or adverse situations where there's competition.
Okay, thanks.
And conflict.
Vice Chair Bile.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make the observation that I also bought a new car, and it's got cameras all the way around that yell at me if I get too close in any direction. I'm just hoping I don't begin to ignore that. I'm particularly curious about statistics relating to motor carrier and whether we have detailed statistics on timing, levels of motor carrier traffic, locations of that traffic. What is available to us in terms of kind of taking a look at the real motor carrier situation growth and projections?
And just to note, we will have an update on motor carrier on Friday, and right. Ms. Ramsdale will be here, and she may actually have more detailed information than these gentlemen, but please feel free to have at it if you'd like.
Chair McEwen, Co-Vice Chair Vile, we do have a couple of answers to that. We do traffic counts, so we do have numbers relative to truck traffic, and we actually have maps that show that information. We've actually also, one of the things that I think that you're getting at a little bit is, with the model that we do, we also have a freight model, try to understand how the traffic is moving and the commodities are moving. We actually just finished, as part of our freight advisory committee request and as an implementation of the freight plan, sort of what we call some freight delay areas, where we were sort of looking at the capacity of the roadway, looking at the movement of the freight, and we've actually identified, and I don't really want to call them bottlenecks necessarily, because they're parts of the interstate or some of our key highways where we're seeing congestion happen, but we're not necessarily knowing what's causing that congestion. That's sort of the second phase of that. So I don't know if that's helpful. We'd be glad to talk to you further if you have some interest specifically, but I think the chair is correct. Ms. Ramsdale will have some numbers if that's what you're looking for.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if we could return to Mr. Mather's last slide. And I'm wondering if he could draw some comparisons or put some context around this. In the latter years, say from 2020 forward, how would we expect other states to compare with Oregon's situation in that time frame?
Sarah McEwen, Representative Witt. Wow, it's probably very different in different states. The federal component is going to be similar in other states, where the federal bill that the Congress passed a couple of years ago expires in 2021. So our federal funds are relatively known out to that point. Beyond 2021, then we don't know. Maybe a little context on the federal side. There's an 18 cents federal gas tax, and it has generated the amount that I've shown here on the screen, but it does not fully fund the amount of federal money that we receive. I don't remember when that was, but several years ago, that 18 cents stopped generating the amount of money needed to support this amount of money, and they've been backfilling that with general fund or other means at the federal level. That problem, that fundamental problem with the solvency of the federal trust fund, hasn't been dealt with in any type of long-term way. It only until 2021 were they able to come up with the amount of federal revenue to meet that. Beyond that, there's going to be something long-term at the federal level to maintain even this level of funding at the federal level. Other states, as far as the bond, there's different combinations of bonding programs like the Oregon legislature has done. They're shown on here. Other states have done that. They've recently, several states have passed fairly aggressive gas tax increases in different formats and different ways to fund their transportation needs, some bonded, some not bonded. But there's not really a kind of one-size-fits-all. It's very kind of tailored to the needs and the dynamics of the state.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up.
I'm trying to
understand what looks like could be a rather alarming situation and an over-reliance on the federal government. And could we, in part, explain this because the state doesn't have any projects on the books or in planning or ready for execution in those latter years?
Chairman McEwen, Representative Witt, yes. I would simplify maybe the transportation need that we have in the state, both on the congestion side as well as just taking care of our infrastructure. The amount of money we need is really the top end of this graph. If you take the peak of what I call the mountain graph and extend that out, that's what our needs are.
Uh-huh.
That's the ongoing funding we need in an ongoing way, not in a bonded way. And that's the challenge that we face, is we have kind of the foundation set at the federal level, and now that gap between what we're receiving in the federal level and what we need overall to maintain a robust transportation system, both from a maintenance preservation standpoint and a congestion relief standpoint. That's about the amount of money you need.
Thank you very much. And, Madam Chair, I would detect a note of caution here, perhaps, that an over-reliance on bonding versus what we need and what we are able to provide as a state. Thank you very much. I appreciate
that. Thank you, Representative Witt. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask a question about the cable barriers that we're now seeing, especially along the interstate. I'd like to know where they came from, how successful they are. You know, as a motorcycle rider, I realize that we're a great minority here, and things are probably predicated for other vehicles. But we're always looking for escape routes, especially at highway speed on the interstate. The cable barriers cut off an escape route for us and cause us to remain part of whatever bad thing just happens in front of us. And frankly, I would do anything rather than to run into one of those cables, just sideswipe it at 70 miles an hour. And so my question is, where did they come from? How are they doing? And as an example, yesterday I saw maybe 200 yards of flattened cable barrier in the Albany area. It really caught something, or didn't. But anyway, just a little more about that.
Context on cable barriers, Madam Chair. Representative Wilson, cable barriers have been around for several decades. They're not really new technology.
No, but they're new here.
They're new here, yeah. Right. As you travel across the country, I'm sure you've seen them used widely across the country, and they're relatively new to Oregon. We put the first major installation of cable barriers in the mid-90s between Salem and Portland, where we were experiencing crossover crashes on the interstate with really some pretty horrific consequences with head-on collisions on the interstate. After that installation, we saw obviously a dramatic decrease in those type of situations. But as you noted, even now that we've had the cable barrier south on I-5, and we plan to continue to install those on the entire interstate system where the median is 100 feet or less. Mm-hmm. But it's a common occurrence to drive down the interstate and see where the cable barrier has been hit and think about if that cable barrier hadn't been there, what the consequences could have been. And with our increase in traffic volumes, so the increased frequency or probability of those crashes occurring in those crossover, plus with what Troy was talking about from just the road departure type crashes that we're seeing an increase of, the cable barriers are extremely low cost, extremely effective in stopping that. The alternative would be to stop those, we would put a solid barrier subtype, whether it's a traditional metal guardrail, whether it's a concrete barrier. All those things are the physical barrier we need to do to separate those traffics. As a motorcyclist, all those things are going to provide a barrier you're not going to want to hit in any kind of vehicle, but especially from a motorcycle standpoint. But they're all physical barriers we're needing to do to respond to the increase in road departures and these horrific crashes and head-on high-speed, especially on our interstate divided highways that we're seeing.
I might just follow
up. Yes, sir.
Just to follow up, it always gives me the creeps when you only have Scotch broom separating oncoming lanes.
Right.
You know, I don't like that a bit. But I do want to say that from a motorcycle rider standpoint, to run into solid concrete or sideswipe is survivable and you won't lose a limb. And if it is the same way with the traditional metal barriers, you can survive that too. But running into one of these cable barriers is like running into a cheese grater. If you're going to sideswipe it, it's going to be really ugly. I think that we always used to figure that due to the fact that the medians were grassy and soggy for much of the year, that would stop a lot of the traffic from crossing over into oncoming lanes. And I think we relied on that. Anyway, I don't know where I'm going with that other than to say, the cable barriers work for a lot of modes of traffic, but it's not good for motorcyclists. I always really appreciate when the cable barrier is over on the other side of the freeway. And I know sometimes it's on my side, sometimes
right.
on the other. I don't really know why it is that way.
Maybe. Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, we do that just from a maintenance standpoint. If you put it in the very center of those medians, it's exactly what you described as the soggy, grassy part. And when we have to maintain that center, median, soggy, grassy part, that it becomes a barrier for our ability to maintain the grass and other. If we keep it up on the gravel side of one side or the other of the freeway, we're in an area that we don't have to maintain the vegetation on that side. And it's just an easier access and easier to maintain that. I guess I would add to the conversation the other thing we're doing to warn drivers or discourage or reduce the amount of road departures is a very aggressive approach in rumble strips. You will see rumble strips on the shoulder. You will see rumble strips in the center line of divided or of two-lane highways. Another very low-cost, very effective way to warn drivers that they are in a situation where they're potentially in a departure situation.
Just thank you. One final thing about rumble strips. Generally speaking, I like those. But just from a motorcycle rider standpoint, on a rainy day, they become repositories of water. And when trucks go over the rumble strip, they suck it out, throw it up in the air. And on a summer day, too, along I-5, Once again, the rumble strips collect hay, stubble, particles of all kinds. And when a vehicle in front of you runs over the rumble strip, boy, you've got to hide your eyes. You've got to look down at your tank or just shield your eyes for, you know, a couple of hundred yards. You know. But all in all, I think those are good.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Do you think we could build a separate set of roads just for motorcycle riders? Now, Troy, you had mentioned being impaired, alcohol, texting, marijuana. Do you have, are there any, can you tell when someone gets in a wreck because of marijuana?
Madam Chair and Representative Barreto, great question. There are chemical tests that can detect the impairing substance, the psychoactive substance within marijuana, the THC. There are two chemicals within that compound, that one is inert and one is that would end up being impairing. The way that that test is done is through a blood test. Oregon is a urine-based testing state for impaired driving, breath and then urine. Blood is typically only done when it comes to a situation of a search warrant. Urine can detect the ingredient in marijuana but cannot differentiate between the inert and psychoactive substance. So officers in a search warrant process where it's, you know, manslaughter, criminal vehicle, you know, that level, go through the process of search warrant to obtain the ability then to draw blood. But that right now is the only confirmatory test that is available and has been proven scientifically to be in a stand in a court of law to be able to provide that evidence.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
So in a fatality, do they do blood testing in every fatality?
Madam Chair and Representative Barreto, not in every case. If it's a single vehicle, single occupant situation, they may not, but it's up to the determination of the investigating officer and agency as to how far they will go through to look for evidence, such as whether there needs to be a blood test through when there is you know, dealing with that scene. And another example I can extend just a little bit, the same as with these. This is also protected under the Constitution related to private property and for search and seizure. So law enforcement has to go through a search warrant process to figure out whether or not I was engaged with this device when I was behind the wheel as well. High protections for the people on our transportation system. There are avenues for law enforcement to use, steps and stages they go through. I believe the body, legislative body this session, does have a couple potential bills, you know, along the lines, Representative, you're asking about. The testing ability and on some of the distracted driving pieces as well.
Thank you. Vice Chair Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Safety-related question related to those, that 90% increase of human error. You said that the alcohol-related or impairment was going up, but do you have any statistics on distracted driving?
Madam Chair and Co-Vice Chair Meek, we have tracked distracted driving and broadly, as well as then using a mobile electronic device within the crash data. Collection of that information is very sparse and inconsistent. Part of it in Oregon, if there's a traffic crash that occurs, the citizens have to file. And there's a citizen report, and then occasionally, about 40% of the time, there's an officer report. Well, in the citizen report, am I going to mark that I was on my phone? And so part of that, the data that's coming in the crash file is what the individual admits to. And as I just mentioned to Representative Barreto, as far as law enforcement being able to determine whether or not this device was used, it comes under a search warrant process because of that protection. So we have data. It is very thin, and we know it is way underrepresented, particularly when we couple that with what's called an observe use survey. In the city of Bend 2 years ago and this last year in LaGrande, we conducted a project with law enforcement and with the community focused in April on distracted driving. Part of that was before we ever did the media and the potential law enforcement, we had someone at roadside looking in the vehicle and counting how many people were on a phone or an electronic device. And then did media to alert people that it's against the law, did an enforcement wave, and then checked to see what the use was like. And the use went down, but it isn't zero. And so when you couple those two things side by side and then public opinion polling too, the crash data looks woefully short of what is perceived and looked at to be out on the road and streets today. So it's there, but it's not a database I would that we could really pull a lot of lot from because it's just so thin.
Great.
It sounds as though this is a hot topic for this committee. Yeah. And committee members, if you would like to have a little more deep dive into this, I'm sure that we could arrange to have more information brought before the committee if it's something that you're interested in pursuing. We're going to run out of time for our two bills and for Mr. Zwecker, so I want to move on. But I do have a couple of things I want to flag, and maybe we could follow up. One is the issue of, you know, we're looking at alcohol and drug incidences creating a 50% increase, which is enormous and very stunning. But we have an epidemic of opioid addiction, which are prescription drugs as well. So is that factored into this?
Madam Chair, I've decided just the alcohol piece. There is a broader impaired driving by drugs. Mm-hmm. I only went impaired driving by alcohol. And we do track as best we can when there's a toxicology screen done, as was mentioned earlier, related to the blood screen on fatal crashes. And I can report back to you the different substances that are on board when people are behind the wheel when a fatality has occurred.
I would be interested to see that. And Paul, one thing, I know it's calling out the obvious, but we do have a number of new members. And I may want you to come back at another time and talk about the different colors of money related to the transportation sector so that we all clearly understand which dollars can be spent on what aspects of the transportation system. So let's flag that for another day.
Just very to make good. Sure. I think this chart that I have here just kind of scratches the surface.
There's some constitutional issues
and others that I think would be good for you.
Exactly. And I'd like to clarify that for the committee at some point,
Chair,
if you don't mind coming
could
back.
Could I flag one more?
Yes.
Going along with that, you know, when you talked about Connection Oregon and when you talked about money that we're integrating into either local or with federal funds, have you guys done an analysis on where we get the best bang for our buck or where we get the best spin around as far as more dollars when we spend dollars? So when the state spends dollars with feds or the state spends dollars with the STIP or the state spends dollars with Connect Oregon, has there been any analysis of where we get more projects or where we get more bang for our buck as far as spinning up partners?
Flag that. We'll bring it back. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Plain, we'll flag that because Connect Oregon is unique and that would require a match. Mm-hmm. It's not required through the federal and state projects. So
thank you very much. Well, I'm sure we will be seeing you again very, very soon. Director Zwecker, if you don't mind, we have Representative Gomberg in the room, and he has a bill that we would like to address. Do you mind waiting just a few minutes, and we'll allow Representative Gomberg and Ms. Joyce, if you want to come up and join him, thank you very much. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2575, and welcome Representative Gomberg to our committee right out of the chute, first day. Thank you for being here.
My goodness. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And it is a really great pleasure to be here, not only with the first bill that we've heard in this committee, but at 9:14 on February 1st to have my first small business bill. Mm-hmm. So for the your record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast, which in this particular case, it's salient that the Pacific City is in the center of my very scenic district. And what I'm bringing to you today was intended to be a simple bill to address a straightforward problem. Now, if you're familiar with Pacific City, you know that it is the home of the historic dory fleet. The historic dory fleet are small sport fishing and commercial fishing vessels that don't pull up to a dock, but actually pull up onto the beach. They pull up onto the beach, I might add, between beautiful Cape Kiwanda and the Pelican Brew Pub there in Pacific City. If you haven't seen them, you really should come out and take a look. So we have these vessels that come ashore, commercial vessels and sport vessels, and everything was all well and good until we encountered a requirement in Oregon statutes that said that commercial trailers are required to have mechanical brakes. So let me say that again. We have trailers that are designed to pull out onto the sand, to pull out into the surf, to pull out into the salt water, and they're required to have mechanical working brakes on them. You see the problem? And the simple solution was that we were going to amend the statute to simply add balanced trailers transporting a dory to the list of exemptions to that requirement. Straightforward problem, simple fix. nothing's ever as simple as you think or
welcome
want
to the
it
Oregon
to be.
Legislature, Representative.
Noted, Madam Chair. And the problem is this, that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration enforces the requirement that each state must meet minimum standards included in federal regulations for commercial vehicles, and states that don't meet those standards can face the loss of federal funding. Well, I wanted to help out our Dory fleet. I didn't want to jeopardize all the funding for state highways. So I became aware of this potential conflict very recently, but smarter heads than I took a look at the problem and came up with the potential for an amendment solution. So I'm going to turn to Ms. Joyce, who is that, in fact, person who's smarter than I am about these matters, and see if we can fix this problem but not jeopardize our funding in the process, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Joyce?
Good morning, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce. I'm from the Department of Transportation, representing today here our Motor Carrier Transportation Division. As discussed earlier, Amy Ramsdell, the administrator of that division, will be giving an overview to you on Friday, so you'll learn more about what Motor Carrier does and a lot of the federal regulations that they enforce. So that as backdrop, Representative Gomberg's bill implicates to a very small degree the potential of violating federal regulations. So federal regs, as he quoted, require brakes on all axles on a commercial motor vehicle. These dories on the trailer connected to a truck would meet the definition of a commercial motor vehicle. However, Oregon is allowed to adopt some exceptions to the federal requirements when you're in intrastate commerce, which presumably most of these vessels would be. We're allowed to do that because Oregon had a safety program far longer than when the Fed started regulating these things, and so we're grandfathered in and given some leeway. So we believe we can utilize that to a large degree to get to the vast majority of the problem that Representative Gomberg has identified. We think we can work with his office to craft a small amendment to comply with federal regulations, but in general get to what he's trying to accomplish here.
All right. Questions for this panel? Yes.
Just a quick question.
Representative Noble.
I'm assuming then the mechanical brake issue is similar to when I back my boat, when I go head over the Coast Range into Tillamook Bay or Neatarts Bay, is the salt water and having to essentially rebuild my brakes every year. And that becomes problematic.
Madam Chair, Representative Noble, that is the essence of the problem, although this one aspect you've left out is that some of my people are now starting to get cited by state police for not having mechanical brakes on their trailers that back into the salt water.
Sure. If I could, what's the average weight of a dory?
I think that varies depending on the size of the dory and the size of their catch, Madam Chair, Representative Noble.
Oh, I was curious.
And I was just trying to check because I think this applies to combinations over 10,000 pounds is the regulation.
Correct.
Ms. Joyce?
That's correct, Chair McEwen and Representative Noble.
Thank you. Okay. Then what we will do is look forward to a forthcoming amendment, and we will stand down until we see something else come across the desk. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your consideration this morning.
And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2575 and open an informational hearing and invite up Mitch Zwecker, who is the director of the Department of Aviation, to enlighten us about what happens when things enter the air. Thank you, Mr. Zwecker, for being here.
It all makes sense.
Good morning, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mitch Zwecker. I'm the director of the Department of Aviation, and I'm here today to present you with an overview of our agency and the system of airports in the state. And I think they're still waiting to bring up my presentation.
We will wait patiently.
Need a copy? Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we are a independent agency separate and apart from ODOT. A lot of states, the aviation division is part of the Departments of Transportation. There's supposed to be a photograph here that shows our Aurora Air Traffic Control Tower.
They are up on OLIS, but I don't see them here. And I want to make sure ODA, not to be mistaken for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, this is the Oregon Department of Aviation.
With your permission, I'll see if I can load this separately.
Please. They are very nice photographs, Director Zwicker.
I just saw it. There it is. Perfect. Thank you. So this is a Connect Oregon 3 project, the air traffic control tower. Very successful. It's improved the safety at the airport and brought new businesses to the airport as well. So our mission as the Department of Aviation is really to focus on the development of airports, economic growth, and also, probably most importantly, the safety of airports. As a historical perspective, we're one of the oldest aviation agencies in the country. We predate the FAA by many, many years. 1921, the Bureau of Aeronautics for the state of Oregon was founded. It actually helped to build the system of airports here in the state. And you can see by comparison, first powered flight, 1903. And in the FAA as we know it today didn't even really begin until 1958. Excuse me. And the pictures that you see right there, that's Aurora in the 1950s and Aurora today. It's a very vibrant airport with about 1,000-plus jobs at the airport itself. We are based on a modal system plan. You heard Jerry Bohard talk about we're part of the Oregon Transportation Plan as well. So the modal system plan last updated in 2007, and we're currently, with funding from the FAA, updating the system plan in 2017-2018. We've got two consecutive grants from the FAA for that coming up over the next 2 years. There are 97 public use airports in the state. The state owns, our agency owns and operates 28 of them. There are 55 that are federally funded. And then there's 7 that are air carrier airports. And then we also register private airports in the state and pilots and aircraft. There's over 4,000 of each, pilots and aircraft. This is the breakdown of who owns the public airports. So the state, you can see, owns about 28% of them. Cities, privately owned public use airports, about 16%, counties, ports, and then federal agencies like U.S. Forest Service. And then the question I'm asked a lot is, why do we have public use airports? And I think the answers are here, transportation mode, but they're also very important to businesses. Businesses locate where there's aviation transportation. They want to be able to get that just-in-time part. So one of the things that businesses look for is an airport nearby where they can get to and from, especially the national and international businesses. And then it's also tourism, the motels, restaurants, and local businesses benefit from that. You may have heard about the $100 hamburger or the $200 hamburger. People fly someplace, they'll meet, have lunch, and then fly back home. That's mostly recreational flyers. And then there's a tremendous amount of agricultural aviation in the state here. You've all seen Christmas trees being hauled around by helicopters. And then there's a lot of emergency services that are provided. In the 28 airports that we own, in any given year, about 6 or 7 of them will be used for firefighting around the state.
Director Zwicker, where does the Coast Guard fit in here, the Coast Guard air stations?
They use the airports. They're based at Astoria and Coos Bay, but they use those airports to base at times. They may refuel at them.
So when you look at the federally funded air facilities, that is an overlay. It's not...
Clear
me up on this.
Okay, so they operate out of Astoria and out of Newport and Coos Bay.
Newport and Coos Bay, yeah.
So they're operating doing search and rescue, other types of logistics up and down the Oregon coast. So as a federal agency, they perform a vital function, but they do operate out of other airports as well.
Out of the local facilities, so they're leasing?
They may not have a lease. They may own the property, or it's on a federally funded airport where they're maybe they don't they're not required to pay that that lease.
Okay. I'm just not certain how that all works. I'd like to know more a little bit about it. Can I flag that for you?
Chairman,
to help
McEwen,
me understand it better. That would be great. I just don't see it right here.
Madam Chair, Representative Evans. Madam Chair, as you're getting that piece clarified, it might also be helpful to break out the two federal facilities, one Klamath Falls specifically, where the Air National Guard has
Kingsley Field.
Because of their particular mission, I would believe that the ownership of at least part of that airfield is different than you're going to find with the Coast Guard.
Yeah, anyway, just for clarification, maybe you could get back to us.
Chairman McEwen and Representative Evans, I'll get some information for you. And then last but not least, there's the recreational aviation. And again, there's about 4,000 plus pilots that are relatively active flyers. This is the list of federally funded airports around the state. The little blue that you see are the general aviation airports. And then with the little airplane symbols is the airports that have commercial air service of one type or another. And then you can look out at Pendleton, which is what's called an essential air service airport. And they get subsidized by the federal government for their commercial air service to and from Portland. This is a map of the 28 state airports, kind of evenly distributed around the population centers in the state. You'll notice that there are several of them along the coast. We'll talk in a few minutes about the importance of airports in a Cascadia-type event. And we serve a wide variety of constituencies around the state, all the different FAA, the governor, legislature, the aviation industry, pilots and aircraft. We've become involved in the UAS industry. We actually now register public use drones. We work on a regular basis through a program called the Statewide Capital Improvement Program for airports owners and sponsors, and then also a small role with commercial air service airports. And then obviously we're always responsive to the Oregon citizens. We're a small agency, but we have a lot of different roles, and I put the statutes for each one of them so that you can see that we don't make it up out of whole cloth here. We do operations and maintenance for the 28 airports. We inspect airports. We do about a third of the state per year on the public use airports. We actually get trained by the FAA and funded by them to do some of those inspections. We do a tall structures analysis to make sure that around airports that we look at any new construction or buildings that are done and make a determination of whether or not that's a safe place to put it. And that's based on a FAA program that we use for what they call Part 77 airspace. And then we do a pavement maintenance program that was funded initially back in 1999. And that program, we do about a third of the state again. And we provide a kind of an economy of scale where we will do an evaluation and then hire the contractor and work with all of the public use paved airports in the state that want to participate in the program. We do a statewide capital improvement program, which was actually proposed to us by the FAA as a three-state program with Idaho, Washington, and Oregon, and I think we've done a very good job of that here. And what that does is we're the liaison between the FAA and some of the state airports, not necessarily the ones that we own, but we have some expertise and continuity that we can provide. Many small communities don't have a dedicated airport manager with our particular person that we have involved in that. We actually help with their grant program and coordinate with the FAA. And we license the 97 public use airports in the state, register the private airports, and then we register pilots and aircraft, as I mentioned before, and then we promote business and aviation where we can. And again, providing some expertise that we have, we assist airport sponsors. We have a 7-member policy board, the transportation advisor for the governor, Carmen Ford. We work with her very, very well. And then our central services are done by ODOT. This is the pavement maintenance program that I talked about. As I mentioned, a third of the state per year, about a little short of $1 million a year that we spend on that, and that's funded by a half cent of fuel tax. And the FAA funded a study for us here about 3 years ago, and what we found is that pavement maintenance program actually extends the life of the runways and the pavement by as much as 20 years on average. Now, there's obviously some exceptions depending on environment. But that really is a great cost avoidance for those airports that benefit from the program. We are an entirely other-funded agency, no general or lottery funds. Our fuel, our funding comes from jet fuel and avgas. And then we have about 300 leases or access agreements for what's called through the fence. And then we have a couple of airports where we benefit from fuel flowage, and we have two airports where we actually sell fuel, where fixed base operators, the people who sell fuel, couldn't make a go of it, and we have the fuel tanks there, so we continue to sell fuel there. And we prefer to have that done by private enterprise, and if somebody comes along, we'd be happy to work with them to create an environment where they could operate their own FBO. And we do pilot aircraft registrations, the source of funds for those. For aircraft registration, it helps offset the cost of our FAA airports, the infrastructure projects that we do. They're funded at 90% of project costs, so that aircraft registration cost actually covers that 10% for us.
Representative McClain.
I just don't want you to leave this slide because you mentioned the word through the fence, and I wanted to talk about, you said you had 300 leases for through the fence, and the discussion last time I remember we were talking about that, it was dealing with the classification of an airport being rural and didn't have a tower, and we actually had Aurora being one of those. You showed the tower. We have a tower now. You wanted to maintain the leases, which were through the fence, and usually you don't have through the fence if you have a tower or you're a bigger airport. So can you explain to me how that's been working, and also, again, can you give me the numbers of how many, those 300 leases are at how many airports?
Chair McEwen, Representative McClain. So last question first. The 300 leases are at a number of the 28 airports that we own and operate. That includes Lebanon. Independence is another through-the-fence airport, but it's a residential through-the-fence airport. There are a tremendous number. There's about 230-something homes there. We have a number of them at Molino, leases at Molino. We have a number at Cottage Grove, Bandon State Airport. So they're really all over the state, far west is, or east is Joseph. And then regarding the air traffic control tower, the legislation adjustment that was done in the last session was to remove the requirement that a through-the-fence airport for commercial purposes could not have an air traffic control tower by virtue of the fact that Aurora State Airport had a number of through-the-fence access agreements. We were out of sync with state law by requiring that it could not have an air traffic control tower. So in my view, it was a correction of that situation. And the definition of rural under that statute at the time was 500,000 or less. So there are many or several different definitions of rural around the state, but for that particular definition under the aviation statute, it was 500,000 or less, pretty much everything that didn't include the Portland metropolitan area.
And the only reason I asked was because it seemed like there were some connections to safety issues, and there were also some connections to what kind of uses, you know, right next to an airport, and what kind of businesses were being leased as through-the-fence businesses. And so if there's something out there that I could read that just tells me that the world is good and that basically that's working well, because, I mean, there was a reason why you had those two definitions, rural, the amount, the size, and the tower. And, you know, Aurora is very different than it used to be, as you pointed out yourself. And so there's just, for safety reasons and other reasons, I'd just like to see the report on how it's working.
And Chair McEwen, Representative McClain, I will try to get you some information on that. From my view, I think it's working quite well. The businesses that are up there are fairly robust. We have two of the three largest heavy-lift helicopter companies in the world that are there. We have the largest kit-built manufacturer of aircraft, Vans Aircraft, is up there. We have Life Flight's headquarters up there. We have Metal Innovations, which does a lot of work for Department of Defense, metal fabrication and repair. So there's a tremendous number of businesses up there. We have three fixed-base operators up there. It's almost unheard of to have that many. So I can...
Committee members, we have 10 minutes left, and we still have a bill we have to hear. So I'm going to ask Mr. Zwecker to speed through so we can have Mr. Gard come up. And I'm assuming it will be a quick presentation for this bill, but we'd like to get through our agenda today. So thank you very much.
And Chair McKeown, I'll try to speed this up.
Yeah,
so impact of aviation in Oregon, this is from a study in 2007, actually updated in 2012. $318 million in FAA funding has come into this state, over $100 billion in grants from Connect Oregon, and it's a $22 billion industry in the state with about 76,000 jobs. And again, that's a study done by Mead and Hunt. This is one piece of data I think is very interesting here, and that is if you look at the amount column here, you'll see the total amount of $370,000. You look up top at the aviation, these are Connect Oregon grants received, 86,000 plus, and this is through Connect Oregon 5. The previous slide said it was over 100 million. But if you look all the way over at the column in yellow, 59% of all the leveraged dollars, 317,000, comes from aviation because aviation projects aren't looking for the entire project cost. They're looking for the 10% grant match to leverage federal FAA grants. So it's a very, very good program for the state in terms of benefits for aviation.
Right.
Strategic initiatives, we're updating the Oregon Aviation Plan in 2017. We're doing a study with Caraggio Group. We would love to have representation from the legislature on how aviation should continue to operate in the state. And then we support jobs and industry in the state. And I will talk just a moment about Cascadia Resilient Airports. They're going to be huge for the state in the event of a Cascadia type event, airports and aviation. My background is helicopters, retired Navy, so I understand how that role is going to play place. We've been talking to Mike Harriman and others, Representative Evans, about what role we might play in the event of a Cascadia type event.
Thank you.
And then here are some bills that are, I'm sorry, I Chair McKeown, did Representative Evans, do you have a question?
Nope.
Okay. This is proposed legislation for this session. One of those is ours, SB 27, which is abolishes pilot registration fees. There are a couple to do away with leaded fuel, one in the House, one in the Senate. And if there are no other questions, there may be a couple of other UAS bills coming down the road as well.
I think we'll have a chance to visit those when the time comes. Some of these we've seen before, and they are bills that are returning, and we'll have a chance to deliberate on them when they come. So, thank you.
One bill was passed in 2015 session is to increase jet fuel and avgas by 2 cents per gallon to basically instead of grant program. That grant program is off to a good start. Tomorrow we have a review of multiple projects that were done. 50% of that funding goes to support airports around the state, prioritized in this order, FAA grant match, emergency disaster relief infrastructure, and economic development. The first tranche of money, there's going to be six iterations of it here, the bill sunsets in 6 years. And the first iteration of that, we're able to fully fund the first section, contingent upon Aviation Board approval and the ACT Representative Committee, who is looking at that. And then some of the emergency and disaster relief infrastructure projects, which are not big projects, and even got into some of the economic development projects here. And the grant project is process is very simple. The aircraft owner submits, and it goes to the Area Commissions on Transportation, and then it gets approved by the Oregon Aviation Board. The other parts of that are to promote commercial air service, 25%, and then our 28 state-owned airports benefit from the other 25%. Most of those that are not federally funded have had a tough time, and we haven't been able to do much with them financially, so they have some backlog maintenance that needs to be done. Drones, a big issue in the state. I will go very briefly over this just to tell you that there are three test sites in the state, and they're actually starting to get some traction and attract some businesses around the state. And they have tremendous benefits for agriculture, forestry, fish and wildlife, and even emergency management. So I think we're going to see a paradigm shift in how aviation is done around the world, and Oregon is on the forefront of that. There are already close to 200 companies in the state that operate drones, and there are more registered unmanned aircraft systems right now with the FAA than there are manned aircraft. That's in a very short time.
And to the committee, at some point, if we have committee time available and you would like a briefing on this industry, it is fascinating. I've seen it in other venues, and it's just it's a whole new world out there. So if it's of interest to you all, we could bring in some of the experts that are dealing on the forefront, not only on the business side of it, but on what the application side is globally and the things that these drones can do. So we'll flag that. Thank you.
And I'll close with, for the benefit of the committee, there's a stakeholders work group on drones that works with Representative Huffman and includes stakeholders from ACLU, business, government, and the industry to try to make sure that we look very closely at how we go forward in the state with all aspects of the drone industry. And subject to any questions, that concludes my brief.
Some brief questions?
Related to what?
Representative Witt.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Swecker, are you convinced that in an era when there is increasing interest about intermodal connectivity and an environment where we have overwhelming budget deficits, that it continues to make sense to have an aviation department that is separate and apart from Oregon's Department of Transportation?
Mm-hmm. That is, Chair McEwen, Representative Witt, that's a very good question. And one of the things that we'll be doing this year is looking at how we're structured, what our mission is, and those types of things. We're a little bit unusual in that, and I would, without throwing names around too much, but Senator Johnson had my position at one time, mm-hmm. and I think worked to make us more independent. I think there are benefits, and I think there are drawbacks. The benefits are that we can do policy and work with different policymakers maybe a little bit more easily. The drawbacks are maybe that we don't have quite the resources that maybe some departments of aviation or divisions of aviation that are parts of departments of transportation have. So I think there's going to be a lot that we can look at as part of that study related to that.
And, Madam Chair, if we could all receive copies of that, I would find that interesting.
And we'll
thank you very much.
Our staff, Mr. Walker, can distribute that if you would send it on to committee staff if there's something that can you can give us.
Chair McEwen, that study will be done over the next several months. So when it is completed, we'll be happy to share.
Thank you both.
Representative Evans.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't have a question. I just want to commend the director for the work that he's been doing. We've had a number of conversations and looking forward to strategic investments in areas that will be critical for life safety after a seismic event. Mm-hmm. His previous experience helps open doors to communication that likely could not have happened 5-6 years ago. So I just want to commend his efforts.
Thank you. And I would like to flag one slide that you moved over fairly quickly, which is the potential for the UAS industry. It's ag, forestry, fish and wildlife, emergency management, law enforcement. I mean, the potential reach of this industry is enormous, and Oregon is on the forefront, so we will be hearing more about that. I just wanted to flag that for you all. Mr. Zucker, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it. I'm sure you will be back between now and July 10th, or at what point we end this session, but we appreciate your work.
It'd be my pleasure.
So thank you. So I will end our informational hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2292. And I'd like to call up Mr. Gard, our rail expert. How are you this morning, sir?
I'm trying to get over a cold, so I hope you all can hear me.
Welcome.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee. I'm Hal Gard. I'm the Rail and Public Transit Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I look forward to seeing you on Friday, where I can at least share a little bit more about my entire portfolio. One piece of that portfolio, though, is our state safety oversight program. It's where we provide independent oversight of our fixed rail guideway systems. That's a $50 word for MAX and streetcar. And we came before the legislature in 2015 to bring Oregon statute into alignment with then new federal statute that were enacted through new federal legislation called MAP 21. However, the Code of Federal Regulations had not been finished at that time. They've been completed, but they're still, it's a new law, so they're still working out bugs. So we needed to come back and make some tweaks in order to be able to get our statute in compliance with the changes that came through the federal regulations. So those changes really kind of in summary are, one, to remove the definitions that are currently in statute, out of statute, into an administrative rule. And this is an efficiency, so that as those definitions are easily changed through federal rule, we're not needing to come back to the legislature. It makes us a little more responsive with regard to staying in compliance with the law. There are other language changes where we change may to shall, so that our enforcement responsibilities are much more direct and clear. And then there is a broad name change where we're basically referring to public transportation systems so that our regulatory authority does not extend to things like Portland Zoo Train or really recreational elements. It's really focused on those mass transit light rail elements. So that's really the essence of the law. It's cleanup, gets us in compliance, and allows us to continue to receive our Federal Transit Administration funds within the state of Oregon.
Which we will welcome. Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Gard. We will look forward to seeing you on Friday. Without any questions, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2292 and turn to Mr. Walker to enlighten us about what our agenda holds on Friday.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, on Friday we will hear from ODOT. Once again, from the DMV Division Administrator, Motor Carrier Division, and the Rail and Public Transit Division. And that will, for all intents and purposes, wrap up our agency overview of ODOT. And we will also have two public hearings on House Bill, one on House Bill 2291 and one on House Bill 2403.
Any questions? Well, we have completed our agenda for our first meeting. We're off and running. Welcome to you all. And on that note, we are adjourned, and I'll see you Friday morning.
Thank you.
On that note, we are adjourned, and I'll see you Friday morning.